Hello and welcome to the Midnight Film Review Special True Detective Edition. My name is Brian Stevens, and with me is...
Hey everyone, it's Aaron Wetley from Suburban Dad Pop.
Aaron, welcome back. You made it to week two.
Yeah.
How you feeling?
I'm feeling something. I'm feeling pretty good, I think. How are you feeling? You and the family staying healthy?
Yeah, for a pretty decent stretch, we've been healthy. No sickness in the last week, so that's good.
Good.
A+ on that one. Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, everything seems to be going well here. You know, I work in public schools, and there is a lot of winter crud going around, and I'm going to jinx myself by saying I'm avoided it so far, but so far my family and I have avoided it.
Yeah, I think that I've heard that from so many people. Like, you have no idea how many people have been like, my kids have been sick pretty much since November, and I have a bunch of teacher friends that have mentioned the same thing you are. And my son's teacher has missed quite a few days. She's been sick quite a bit, and it feels like that they're just kind of passing it around the room, you know?
Yeah, kids that age, it's real tough.
Yeah, for sure. So we have, I think, a better show after week one lined up for you here. I'm pretty excited to talk about episode two with you. I got some feedback from some people that I will read to our followers and our listeners. And then you're going to touch on some things, some research that you did about small town Alaska. I don't know why I just did a Matthew McConaughey
impression.
Small town Alaska. And then we'll break down the episode. So again, as always, there will be spoilers for pretty much every season of True Detective. I mean, we're not going to hold back. So, and I think we will agree there'll be probably some spoilers from season one brought up in this because of the way the episode went. But let me start real quick with just going over some of the feedback that I got on some of the questions that I had asked. And you can always, you know, email the podcast at cultofpop@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. And we'll read your emails live on the air and let us know what you think of the show, True Detective, and ask us questions. But first of all, so I got a lot of agreement. I'm not going to read any specific one, but several people said that they found the toddler incident confusing and gross.
Yeah.
Right. So for those who don't know what we're talking about is the Peter and I can't remember his significant other's name, but are literally just messing around with their toddler son feet away. And so many people were like, dude, it was weird. One person said, even if it wasn't a toddler, if it was a baby that was like more than an infant, it was weird. Like pretty much
Absolutely. Is the
feedback that I got. So I think, just an odd choice. I still don't have context
queasy.
For it. Yeah, queasy. And then
not
the other
queasy.
The other big thing, a lot of people agreed with us too about the exposition dumps and the dialogue being clunky. Uh-huh. So it's not just us that felt that. So we got some agreement there. I had a lot of back and forth about the dermal piercings. Some people agreed with me, or at least was like, yeah, I was weird. I felt like, you know, just from a perspective, I had two friends that are cops say that, you know, that wouldn't fly in Ohio, but it's
right.
You know, Alaska's something else. You had brought up the fact that they'll kind of take what they can get. And that was brought up a couple times. And one person lived in Alaska, albeit they mentioned that they lived in Anchorage, Alaska, but
The Manhattan of Alaska.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Big city Anchorage. But they had mentioned that in their experience with traveling around the state that you pretty much just kind of are accepted if you, you know, fit the criteria in terms of education and training, they're going to hire you.
Sure.
The one thing that I couldn't pin down was her role within the policing system. So they said that state troopers, much like I think in Ohio, like you'll have in smaller towns, sheriffs of the county that are assigned to small towns because they don't have enough money to pay village police or city police even. So they'll have a sheriff that's just, I mean, that's the cop in the town, right?
Right.
So the state typically has that, but he also said that sheriffs, and that's kind of what we see in this is there's a state and a sheriff assigned to Anus. So I don't know how the hierarchy works with the state police, but it seems that you're kind of like you're given a large territory, like especially in those outer areas where it's like she may have to cover like hundreds of square miles.
Yes.
And she's the only one and she has to rely on help from the sheriffs.
That's exactly right. I kind of listened to during the course of my work day today, I had a little downtime and I listened to the HBO the HBO podcast for this show. And I hadn't listened to episode one, but I listened to episode two. And Issa Lopez, the creator, was on a big chunk of it. And so were Kaylee Reese and Jodie Foster. Anyway, long story short, Kaylee Reese based the Navarro character played by Lopez based that Navarro character played by Reese on a very specific female Inuit state trooper.
And that's interesting.
And she was that state trooper whose name I should have written down. I apologize. She was on for maybe the last 10 minutes of the episode and she said exactly what you said. It's basically her own outpost, her own borough. She had to cover different areas of the state, different jurisdictions in different districts that were often bigger than the size of some states in the lower 48. And it was really interesting to hear her talk about her job. And she did it for 20 years. And long story short, again, I'm trying to shorten this up, she transitioned out of her state trooper job into like a domestic violence prevention unit. That's really cool. And that's been like the best work of her life. So if anybody else, after you listen to our podcast, of course, go check out the HBO official True Detective Season 4 podcast. It's pretty interesting.
HBO has done a really good job with those podcasts because they do fill in the gaps. Like, I mean, these are things that aren't explicitly said in the episode, but they were questions that at least that we had or, you know, I think that obviously other people had too. And
yeah.
I think that as a companion piece, it's probably a great thing to listen to.
Absolutely.
As well as this podcast. All right, yeah. Aaron, tell us a little bit about the research you did outside of this podcast on small town Alaska and maybe fill some holes in for us.
Sure. So I was just enthralled with the sun going down and the small town life. So Ennis is based on a town I'm not going to pronounce right. The new pronunciation is an indigenous word. I'm going to try it. Ute Kiagavik. That's probably not right. It was formerly Barrow, Alaska. So I'm just going to refer to this as Barrow. My apologies to anyone who takes offense to that, but that's just the best way I can get through this. So Barrow, according to my internet research, is the closest town to Ennis. That's a real town. It's north of the Arctic Circle. It is the borough seat of the North Slope of Alaska. The North Slope is the highest part of the above the Arctic Circle, the highest Alaskan borough. In the 2020 census, the population was 4,927. 2010 census, the population was 4,200. In 2020, that population had jumped up to 4,900. So in 10 years, they had a 14.5 increase in their population, which a lot of cities would kill for. And I thought that was really interesting. And that makes it the 12th most populous city in Alaska.
Wow.
Yeah, which is just mind-boggling that around 5,000 people, it's the 12th largest city. So it's a big, barren area, and it's half the population of the whole borough's population. The whole borough is about 11,000. Around that area, it's 57% Alaskan Native, 21% white, 9% Asian, which goes and plays on some of the tensions I think we saw in this episode between the different ethnic groups. When we get to the extreme weather, the sun sets on November 18th, and it stays all the way down until January 23rd, today.
Oh.
Yeah, so happy sun coming up in probably like 10 hours or something, people of of northern Alaska. And that's so the night, you get 66 days of polar night. That's what they call it, the polar night. On top of that, it's also the cloudiest city in the world. The sun is almost never out. But then when the sun is out, you get the warmest. When the sun is out, you get almost 80 days of sunlight as opposed to 66 days of darkness. And I have to look at my phone real quick for that. And that is in between May and August. You'll have 24 hours of straight daylight. July is the warmest month at a balmy 41.7 degrees. And February is the coldest month at negative 11.9 average.
Ugh.
So that just all is fascinating how people are still moving there. They have a big population growth. I would be so depressed. It just sounds like an awful way to live, but it really, like, I think paints a good picture of maybe fills in some of the gap for our listeners. And one of the things we talked about last week, I'll just go over real quickly, is we saw the line of people going into the liquor store.
Yeah.
So in this very specific city, according to Wikipedia, to get an alcohol permit, residents have to pass a background check, prove they lived in town for at least a month, pay a $200 annual fee, and order alcohol through an alcohol distributor that is willing to ship to the town. The customer has to pay the distributor fees and such on top of all this. And you have a monthly allotment of 11.25 gallons of beer, which I think would be close to a keg from college, I think. Don't hold me to that. 20 liters of wine and 4.5 liters of distilled spirits a month. And according to the person in the Wikipedia article that owns one of these stations, most people order their allotment every month. So that just means you're cooking.
Every Holy smokes. Month. Yeah, right. Okay.
Wow. So that I thought all that was just super interesting. I'm sure you think it's pretty interesting too, but what a way to live.
Yeah, a completely different way to live.
Oh my goodness.
But, you know, there's a reason that people do it. There have obviously been stories. I think of Insomnia, right? It's kind of the reverse of this. The movie Insomnia, Christopher Nolan's film, and they're not necessarily in the same vein of this, but the movie 30 Days of Night, which is a vampire film, which is really good. Actually, I love it. And as far as
you've reviewed it when you're over your Halloween reviews.
Yes. I have talked about 30 Days of Night. And so there are things that have touched on it, but I don't know that things have really dug this deep into the cultural aspect of it or the what it's like just to live there day to day.
Sure.
And that's another interesting nugget about the show that I think does a really good job. Thank you for doing that work for us. And I think it's an important perspective and really everything that you gave us, especially from the podcast as well. Mm-hmm. All right. You ready to dig in?
Let's do it.
All right. So episode 2 of True Detective Night Country, we start out where we left off, and the group of police are the sheriff's department is now digging out these frozen bodies.
The corpsicle,
yes. And what we quickly realize through a couple instances is, one, nobody, with the exception of maybe Danvers, really knows what they're doing. That's one. And two, nobody really cares. Which I don't know
about. Lack of reverence.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but I felt it strange because I don't feel like maybe I'm wrong. With that many people there, you don't see death, or at least this kind of death, very often. So I just thought it was kind of weird, but it also kind of plays to, I mean, I guess the psychological state you would be in, or you may be in if you're living in this town, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just
very, pretty dark.
Yes. So one of the big things about this first scene is they're trying to move the corpses around, get it out, and they snap off a limb, and one of the bodies makes a moan.
Yeah.
Which
more
was
than a moan, a screech.
Yeah, it's like which I don't know about you, but I almost jumped out of my chair, and I was like, I mean, it legit creeped me out and startled me all in one.
Yeah. Right. It was off-putting to say the least. And we talked about last week how some moments took you out. I'm glad that happened right around the credits, because I needed about 30 seconds to get my head back in the game. I was not expecting that.
Perfect timing, great editing, and a great way to start this episode. I mean, it was one of my big A pluses about this episode was that opening scene. It sets everything in motion in a really awesome way, in my opinion.
Right.
We also see it pan to Navarro, and she looks down and all the clothes are folded. in a line. Now, one thing I haven't seen, and I'm not saying that I don't want to like, oh, Brian Kemp's idea. I'm not saying it, but I'm a big, I don't know. There's a podcast called Astonishing Legends. Mm-hmm. So it's about myths. I mean, they cover ghosts and aliens. They cover all kinds of things, but it's also like mysteries like, Amelia Earhart.
Sure.
And one of the episodes that they covered years ago, I mean, this podcast has been on for a long time, was the Dyatlov Pass incident. Are you familiar with Dyatlov Pass?
I am not.
Okay. So I'm going to real quick read from, Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I saw those clothes folded, this immediately popped in my head. I'm like, they're pulling from this.
Okay.
So in 1959, Soviet Russia, a group of 9 hikers, including their tour guide, I'm not going to even try to pronounce some of these names because I'm not sure at Russian, let alone like these names.
Yeah.
So they were going on a trip, and they were led by they were from the Ural U-R-A-L Polytechnical Institute, and they were led by a very seasoned hiker and someone who knew this pass very well. No one had heard from them for a couple of days, so they went looking for them. Essentially, what happened is 4 of the bodies were found in a nearby stream, frozen to death. 2 bodies were missing eyes. 1 had a missing tongue. 1 had missing eyebrows. A few were frozen to death. All were naked. 1 had a small crack in its skull. There were several bodies that showed trauma and other trauma to the soft tissue. There have been numerous theories have been put forth about what happened, including animal attacks, obviously hyperthermia, catabatic winds, infrasound induced panic, military involvement, or supernatural factors.
Right.
So obviously, you know, there is way more to this, and it goes
into each.
You know, if you listen to that podcast, Astonishing Legends, great podcast. The Dyatlov Pass episode is great. It's happened in January of 1959. So this sounds very similar, right? Like
absolutely
to this episode. So I definitely think she pulled from that, and I'm excited to see where she goes with that. Any thoughts on other thoughts on that opening scene?
No, I think you got it pretty well. It's the folded clothes are perhaps the creepiest part. Well, they would be, except for, you know, the eyes burned out and the ears bleeding and just all of it. They just whatever vibe they're going for, I think they got it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So Danvers then leaves and goes and meets with someone she presumably has some kind of relationship with. Maybe friends with benefits or something. I don't know, but he is.
There's a few of those around the town. Not that I'm judging Danvers.
No, we're going to get there for sure.
Okay, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, she is a woman in charge of her wants and needs. So she basically goes there and she's like, hey, do you know what's going on? And he's like, they're madmen. We get a little bit more backstory about what they're doing there, you know, and why they're there. And it's, you know, they're talking about a absolute game changer, I think is what he says. And it's they're digging for an extinct microorganism in the permafrost that would essentially, you know, maybe stop aging or prevent cancer or cure cancer.
Sure.
But he ultimately says that, no, this is impossible.
Something they could make a lot of money at. And it leaves up their motives. Maybe they aren't exactly altruistic. It's kind of up for debate. It'd be all kinds of things.
Right. So we go back to Navarro is visiting Rose, who found the bodies, and her husband Travis led them there. And this will be like my first, again, nitpick of the show. So do you know what I'm going to say here? Is that was one of the things that you're.
It's going to be more just descriptive and story dialogue.
Yeah. Again, the dialogue. Yeah. So it's just, I mean, it's that it's just like, she's making her tell her this story again. And it's like this. And so we find out that Navarro found Travis's body. She's the one who found him frozen. Mm-hmm. So it's like, again, why are you rehashing this? Like, it has nothing. It's not okay. So I played this through in my head.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times cops will in interrogations, they have the people tell the same story over and over again,
right,
to try to find what they're leaving out, what they're leaving in, what this is not the case though, right? She's not even talking to her about this. She's more interested in why she sees ghosts because she wants to help
her sister,
right? Mm-hmm. And so the fact that she's like going through the story is just, it's bad. It's bad dialogue. It's bad.
And it ended with Rose saying to her, and that's where you found Travis.
Yes.
I was like, oh, come on. Come on.
It's like, right. It's like,
yeah,
no one talks like that. No right. one.
So what did you think then when it finally, in the part of that dialogue and they dropped the Cole last name?
Right. So it's so the other part of this is a very important revelation that happens early on, is that it's Russ Cole's dad. I mean, this is his mom and this is his dad that we're talking about. So
I don't think it's his mom.
Oh, you don't?
I don't think Rose is his mom. She has a different last name on Wikipedia.
Good point.
I think she's a younger lover. And I think that early in season one, Travis split up with the mother.
Good point. Yeah.
So this is a different woman who I think is a little bit younger than Travis as well.
Okay.
Can I just go into my whole timeline? I'm going to do something with the whole Cole thing.
Yeah, do it.
Okay. So I'm kind of excited that, you know, I don't want this to be just fan service, but I'm very excited that this is Russ Cole's dad. They've mentioned it. We have the spiral tattoo that Rust, you know, encountered in season one. Maybe it's been mm-hmm. following him his whole life. Maybe time is a flat circle. So I'm all excited about this. So I'm going to do my best to maybe justify how the timeline of just the Cole situation. Okay. So Travis was born, I'm going to say he was born in 1945, because according to super fan pages, Rust was born in 64. So that's going to put Travis about 20 years old when Rust is born.
Okay.
He goes to Vietnam in 1965. Maybe he knows Rust is part of his life. Maybe he doesn't want Rust to be a part of his life. Maybe he's escaping. Maybe he has no idea Rust is even going to exist. So he goes to Vietnam when American troops get there in 1965 at the age of 20. And then comes back after a few years. You know, like I said, Rust is around. So where am I going with my notes here real quick? Okay, so I think Navarro finds Travis around 2005, which would have put him around 60 years old, which is about as far as I'd go age-wise looking at the actor who played him. But I was thinking maybe that would be about the right timeline for him. And maybe Navarro, I'm going to say for my own headcanon to make this match, that True Detective Season 4 is set in 2020.
So that makes sense, yeah.
So Navarro got on the force around 2015. She's known Rose for about 15 years. Okay, so then we get to Rust. Rust is born in 64. He joins the Houston PD in about 84. After he turns, 18, he leaves to go back to Houston. And so he does the undercover thing starting in 90. He does that for around 4 years, and then he loses his mind, and he gets well-ish for Rust. And then the True Detective Season 1 timeline picks up in 1995. That's where the first timeline picks up.
Mm-hmm.
Rust is 31 years old. So by 2012, which is the second part of the True Detective 1 season, our timeline, Rust is going to be 48. And he looks older than 48 when they play that, but man, I mean, that means he's been, for 7 years, for longer than that, for like 17 years, he has been just an alcoholic, chain smoking.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So that could match up. Anyway, I think it matches up. So if Russ left home at 18 in 1982, and he hasn't talked to Travis in 30 years, that means in 2012, that's where the second part of the storyline matches up. And that's what Rust tells the detectives who are interrogating him. They're like, are you still mad at your dad? No, I haven't talked to him in 30 years. I think he died. He had leukemia. So the timeline all matches up if you do it like that. So I don't know. That's just my thoughts. I tried to put some thought and some time into that. But if Travis died around the time he was 60 and he was born in 45, went to Vietnam in 64, and then Rust was born right around that same time, it all matches up. So
yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that all makes sense. I think you laid out a compelling, I mean, it seems like that is the right path, right? I mean, I think you nailed it.
Give or take here or there, but that's just my thoughts.
Great work. And you will see what this means to the show, if it means anything, or if it's just like, hey, sure, like you said, time is a flat circle. We haven't necessarily seen anything completely like we have nuggets that these things are, you know, in the same universe at least,
sure,
right? But we don't know if they are affected or affect each other or will, sure, even matter.
Right.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it makes sense to me. All right, moving on to the next scene, and I think this scene to me, mm-hmm, might have been the best scene so far. And I'm interested to hear what you think about this. I think I skipped a scene. I did. I apologize. Okay. Danvers is called back. Basically, I think I'm doing this right. Danvers is called back to the office, right? Mm-hmm. And so she goes back to the office, and her Captain Conley is there,
right?
And he's basically like, I'm taking you off this case. This is we're getting Anchorage involved. We're gonna ship the bodies back,
and you then don't even have the forensics to do it,
right? And he's making some logical sense. I think, you know, sure, obviously, I don't think that he doesn't think that she's capable, but I think he knows that, like, she doesn't have a good enough team to put forth the effort on this. Like, you're kind of, and she pulls out the playbook and shows him where they can't be moved, right? Can't move a frozen corpse for 36 hours or 38 hours. I can't remember exactly what it was.
I think it was 48 hours after thawed at 38 degrees.
There you go. That's it.
Just because I'm a chef, you know, at home. So
good memory. cooking up body parts, are we?
That's exactly.
All right. So then we again real quick before we move on. It is like, so we had her go to the school. The class is in session. It is so hard to figure out what time.
Oh man,
a day it is.
Sure,
it is so. It's discombobulating, and because it's always night, it's like you're confused. Like, it's like, well, what time is it? Like, and you're like, oh, this is like maybe in the afternoon. I don't really know. Like, so it's really, really confusing.
That lack of perspective is a character itself.
Yes, very much so. I totally agree. So then she goes back to. So then we go back to the school. I should go back. She gets an ice skating rink to thaw these bodies out, right? So we see.
The ice skating rink from a woman she had an affair with the woman's husband.
Right. Yes. Sheesh. Another lover.
Yeah.
It essentially, everybody is pulled from the ice. There's people doing different things, and she has these bodies brought in to thaw out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a scene where Finn Bennett, who plays Peter, and Danvers, and Jodie, who's played by Jodie Foster, they go through this questioning thing, and it harkens back again to season one about asking the right questions. And exactly. I thought this scene was so good because one thing that it does is it fills us in to the clues. It gives us a perspective on the case.
Right.
But also it does character work here too, because we see the relationship between Danvers and Peter. Basically, Peter doesn't want his dad's life. Maybe he does want to live in Alaska, but he wants to be more than just a cop with in name only, right? He enjoys
Danvers is his work parent.
Yes. Yeah.
His own father.
Right. Yes. Right. Exactly. And so he sees this as an opportunity to learn from her. He obviously respects her,
right.
And she sees him as competent and someone who could really be an ally and is good at this job. And so she's essentially, ask the right question. So she's having him ask a question. Oh, you're asking the wrong question. Ask this question. Okay. And then they're going back and forth. And I just really like this because not only did it reveal the case to us and reveal the evidence to us, it wasn't dialogue exposition dump, they were cut with this nut, whatever. Yeah. It was very, it was a very unique way to do that. And it's something that this show hasn't done this far in a good way. And so I felt like the way that the exposition went across and the character moment, this is probably one of my favorite scenes of the entire show so far.
I would agree with all of that. And I think part of the reason it looks so good and it sounds so good is it's because it's the best written scene of season 4 so far.
Yep. Completely agree. Right. And of course it has Jodie Foster, who's doing the acting. So
that yeah. Helps, yeah. So. She and that kid have real chemistry.
I totally, totally agree. So part of those questions though, it's revealed to us, the tattoo, right. So we get the tattoo of the, whatever the
spiral,
circle, spiral.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. The spiral tattoo.
Yeah.
And so, that I think was not only an important clue for this case, but it goes back to season 1 as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned that earlier, but, is this where it did happen before? We should probably just touch on Danvers and Conley. Another very awkward sex scene.
Super awkward. That's exactly what I wrote in my notes. It was, I don't know what happens in Alaska, but people have unconventional. Well, maybe not. I don't. Maybe to me, I don't know. But just, if the crew are going for this is a sexy scene, to me, maybe they're not hitting their mark. To other people, they might be. To me, it's pretty awkward.
Yeah, but again, we have that kind of the juxtaposition between Navarro and Danvers where, he's getting ready to climax and she's like, you are not going to climb. You are not. You're going to wait.
Like, don't you dare is what
don't
she
you
says.
Dare. Yeah, don't yeah. you dare. So again, these two characters who are seemingly at odds are maybe because they're a lot alike.
Yeah.
And then we get the revelation that not only does Clark have this tattoo on his chest, but Anne also has it on her back, which it leads them to. I should also mention, I feel like this it's not as good as it was last time. I feel like we're bouncing around a lot in this and I apologize. I tried to one to go straight through like we did last time, but we're bouncing around and that's okay.
Absolutely.
One thing that I thought was really interesting is, Peter is like, oh, we can use facial recognition with this guy. This is his phone. Yeah. Let's open it. And they open it. And you had mentioned last episode that like, oh, we're going to, once that happens, we'll maybe see what happens, what is going on. But what did you think of it just like cutting out like that?
That I thought that was cheesy. I don't think it was. Yeah, just cheesy for lack of a better word. It was almost the way they filmed it and it just kind of snapped off. It looked like a dated way to have a screen and not organic really. Like if you're going to save a moment for Peter doing something well to help crack the case, I want it to pay off instead of just kind of be teased right there and not really lead to anything. It was letdown.
I agree. And they better have some major explanation of what would cause that to happen. Right.
Right.
Like it can't just be like, oh, it happened because that's not how phones work. That's not how these things work. Right. So
borderline supernatural, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. And I would be fine if that's the way you're going with it. But again, like you said, it was cheesy the way it was done. And like it feels like a red herring from no disrespect to anybody who loves, CSI or something, but like it just felt like one of those red herrings, like from a basic television show. Like, yeah. All right. So we then get to Navarro is driving down the road and she's having like this moment of bliss, I guess you'd say. Like she's like
bliss and vulnerability.
Yeah. She's got a smile on her face, like she's like happy. And she finds a crucifix necklace, a cross necklace in her car, and it flashes her back to what appears to be her mother's mental spiral.
Yeah.
With her protecting her sister in what appears to be a warm location.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it was like Mexico or like tropical of some sort.
Right, right. Her last name's Navarro, so, you know.
Well, yeah, there you go, yeah.
And the woman cop, the woman's Alaskan state trooper who was interviewed on the HBO podcast today, she was she was of dual races. She was Inuit and Latin. So maybe that's where they kind of got some more of that inspiration from.
What? Wow, what a unique mix that is.
Yeah.
Cool. So we then have this scene where again, I apologize if I'm bouncing around. This is not a very good walkthrough. And so she's now back at, I can't remember the vet's name's house, right? And or was it that before this?
The vet, you mean?
Isn't he a vet, the dude that she's sleeping with? The guy whose toothbrush she stole?
I thought he lives above the store. I thought he was like the cook bartender.
He was taking care of a dog at some point, right?
His pet dog. I think he lives. Okay. It was my impression that he lived above the restaurant and bar.
Yeah, and, I think you're right. Yeah.
And because after she wanted to jump in the tub with him and that wasn't going to happen, like they went downstairs and he had like a nice big kitchen and he made her like a huge breakfast on a griddle and everything. Mm-hmm. And we saw him working in the bar either in this episode, I believe, or maybe one, but he's definitely works at the bar. I think he lives above the bar as well. I think it's his bar.
Oh yeah. It could be. Well,
yeah,
he pushes back on it being a bar at one point. Right.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. 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 He's the proprietor of that food.
Yes.
Business.
You're right. You're right. I guess I just was like, maybe he's a vet too. I don't know.
It's the dark night, man. It's the polar night. It makes you all – it's hard to keep things straight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so there's also – and again, we're just going to have to poke around here because I don't have a really great handle on this episode. But there – I think maybe we can just talk about real quick Peter and his family and the relationship with – so – there's two things here. One, we see John Hawk's character, who's obviously being fleeced by some woman he's giving money to. And he then realizes that Peter took the files out of his house and he's pissed. And he goes and he confronts Peter and he strikes him. Right.
Yeah. Right across the face.
What did you make of that scene?
Man, it's very odd. All of it. Like Hank is he is not a true detective. You mentioned last week, maybe he's in it for the paycheck, benefits, whatever. It took him a few days, obviously, to figure out those files were gone. Or at least one solid day, I believe, in the timeline of the show. He has that mail order kind of bride that's drunk. And then I don't know. I think he's getting catfished by a separate woman.
Yeah.
I don't know. And there's some sort of weird family loss, family dynamic going on with him and his son and the wife who is obviously gone now. And I think it's all going to culminate with a shakedown or a face off with he and Danvers, Hank and Danvers, about who is the real parent to Peter.
Yeah, that's where all this is leading. I agree. Then we see Danvers basically going off on Peter's I would say his wife or girlfriend's grandmother. I think
it's his wife.
wife's so.
Oh yeah, the mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law. Is that his mother-in-law? Yeah. She is just giving a fake tattoo. I forget what it's called. The lip or facial tattoo to Danvers' stepdaughter. And
yes,
she like blows up for some reason.
Because she's kind of sucks, and she's she's not like I'm not asparaging throwing anything about anybody who wants to do anything. You know, if she was a male cop and she's sleeping around, we'd all love her. And I'm not judging her on her sexual exploits, but her jokes aren't great. She can't read the room. She doesn't seem like she gives a shit to read the room. And she's letting the stress from this case interfere in a family situation where she's keeping the father out of his own home. And then she calls the matriarch of the home, which is pretty funny, but still a shitty insult, the laundromat grandma.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, Jesus, lady, like, you kind of suck right now. I hope we see some more redeeming qualities.
That is one thing about the show is, I would say that even Navarro has probably played the best protagonist in this, right? Sure. Everyone else has some pretty bright flaws. Maybe Peter too. I mean, we haven't seen Peter or Navarro have any huge weaknesses. Although, right. I mean,
the dad relationship with Hank is going to be a big weakness for Peter.
Right. Yeah. And let's be honest, that was borderline rape, what she was doing to the guy. I mean,
right.
It's a little dicey there, but I think that for the most part, she seems like a good person. So we haven't seen anything really too much with those two, but Danvers has got some warts for sure. Yeah. She is very prickly. And yeah. So moving on. So let's get to Navarro finds a trailer in what's called the Nook.
Yeah.
And essentially what she does is put together, okay, they were obviously Anne and Clark have a relationship. Mm-hmm. She talks to the tattoo, the person who gave
tattoo artist.
Yeah. Who gave the tattoo to Clark. And this happened, a couple weeks after Anne's death. Mm-hmm. And he was very upset and sad.
Yeah.
And, so she basically logically, like, they had to be meeting somewhere. Where could they meet? Mm-hmm. And her boy toy mentions that he sold Clark a trailer, I think. And he's like, where would you hide a trailer? And they're like, the Nook, which is presumably a RV park that maybe houses.
Make out point, overlook pass.
Yes, there you go. Right.
Yeah.
It's where you go to get your shag on.
Right.
And so she goes there and she finds a trailer that Clark had bought off Chuck's cousin. So she then gets a hold of Danvers and they go in together.
Yes.
And this is creepy part 2.0 because this thing is littered with all kinds of hanging dolls, animal bones, doodles, like just like cave drawings, basically.
Right. Annie's phone is there.
They find Annie's phone.
There's a spiral tattoo or spiral painting on the top of the cabin or the trailer, excuse me.
Yep. And a stuffed mannequin dressed in Annie's clothes.
Yeah.
Which was really disconcerting. So we are then faced with, I guess, a question. This some kind of like altar or like someplace for him to like, you know, remember her, or is he completely off the deep end? Right.
Right.
What did you make of this trailer?
I don't think that those have to be mutually exclusive. Like he can be completely off his shit. And then he goes there to reminisce about the times they spent together. Pretty creepy is what I thought for sure. There's a lot of callbacks to season one with a lot of the, again, the swirl imagery. Some of the dolls I think that they found were kind of like the dolls in the bayou that some of the evangelicals had. I think those matched up pretty well. It's just all pointing towards, it's all building to what this big mystery is about, what the swirl tattoo is, and time being a flat circle and the supernatural element. And I think I wasn't sure how this episode started out and how it was going, but when I got to this point in the episode, I was like, okay, I'm on board. If nothing else, I want to see where the story goes.
Agreed. Yep, totally. So one thing that I think that the show is doing really good at right now is they're giving us just a little bit of these, because basically I feel like the mystery is how are Clark and Annie connected? Obviously, right. Did Clark kill her? Did Clark kill these people? Did something drive him crazy? Did he, do it? Like, there's a lot of surrounding that. But also, what connected these two? Why were they so passionately in love, and why were they hiding it?
Yeah.
That, to me, is a key to this whole thing. Is
absolutely.
Why was Clark not allowed to have this relationship? Why were they keeping it a secret? I think is a big question.
Yeah. Ask the right questions. I think that's one of the good questions. And I'm sure, I would imagine a part of it would be that she is protesting about what he's doing, basically drilling into the ice, and maybe the water's getting polluted because of that. And that's what they mentioned when a scene between the white people and the indigenous people drilling the bad water at the restaurant/bar.
Right. Yeah.
That was a part of it. So I think they both had to kind of keep a cover from their peers.
And right. Yeah. Cause I mean, if you think about it, Annie is very, she's hippy dippy. She's standing on her morals, but at the same time, she's romantically involved in someone that maybe is doing something that she shouldn't agree with. Right. I mean,
right.
Very Romeo and Juliet-esque, but not necessarily the same idea. One other thing I think also we should touch on is, again, this goes back to season one with the dolls and I forget what they're called, those little wooden straw dolls. I can't remember, but very similar to season one too. One thing too, and I forgot to mention because it wasn't in this recap, but we see Danvers. We get a flashback of Danvers with her her son.
Yes,
and we get a little piece of that in this as well.
And to the background of "Shake It Up" by the Beatles.
That's yes, that
she's reminiscing.
Yes,
about and the Star Scar teddy bear. Polar bear doll plushie. I thought that was nice. Yeah. So I think going back to our episode last week, I think I feel justified in saying that bear wasn't really there when she woke up, because the bear was there in the Christmas decorations.
Yep.
So I think that she has seen ghosts with that bear. A lot of people in the Dark Knight and the Polar Night see ghosts.
Ooh, I like that.
Rose mentioned that, earlier in the episode. And I think that maybe that's the ghost that Danvers is seeing.
I like that. I didn't think about that. That's good. Good point.
Even the ghost board, somebody said that. And I thought that was a great line of dialogue.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. So I guess we have one more scene to talk about. But I guess one thing that I'm a little bit maybe, and again, maybe this is just being discombobulated by the day night stuff.
Sure.
So they're home and she's putting up whatever, and her daughter's getting ready to sneak out. And
I think I know where you're going. Go ahead.
And she sees the bear and she kind of like stops everything.
Yeah.
And then, Does she get a call from Navarro to come to the trailer?
I think so. Yeah, she definitely, Navarro tells her to come to the trailer. I think that might be later on in the episode, but the part about the daughter sneaking out and for on the Wikipedia page, the daughter's last name is Danvers, for whatever that's worth.
Okay.
but I still think it's a stepdaughter kind of situation like we talked about last week. But so the sneaking out thing, that was, you know, you're talking about getting discombobulated with the day and the night.
Yeah.
So they got home like at 7 and then the daughter snuck out at 8. And then I'm like, where are you going? What time is it? And then she sneaks back in. It's like 10 o'clock. It's very, very, very hard to keep the timeline, like literal timeline of what time it is during the day slash night. It's almost impossible.
It really is. Because there's no reference, a frame of reference. Right. Like the school being let out is like the only thing that you can even like hang your hat on. Is like, okay, it's within the school hours. Like that's it.
Yeah, it's anxiety inducing.
Yeah, it really, really is.
I kind of get the heebie-jeebies sometimes watching. I'm like, I just can't take it.
All right, so the last scene, I have a pretty big issue with the way that dialogue is delivered in this at the very end. Peter calls Danvers, chief, you got to get over here, we got a problem. Shows up and realizes one is, you know, with one being in the hospital, there is one body missing. They quickly realize that it's Clark. So Clark is missing. Mm-hmm. And which I feel like is kind of obvious. I mean, I feel like I wasn't like, oh my God, he's missing. I kind of just expected him to not be there. Yeah. I don't know about you. You
did. Absolutely.
I never expected him to actually be there. But
right.
What drove me nuts was the last line of dialogue between Navarro and Danvers.
Yeah.
So Danvers says something like, I was going to rewatch this part of the episode to get the exact wording down, but I didn't. I wish I would have now. It just slipped my mind before trying to get this, everything set up for this. But something along the lines of, she makes a statement like he's missing or dead or something like that. And Navarro says, or he's still out there. Something along that line.
It was along the lines of, oh, we're one short. And basically what we were saying, like, 6 in the hospital, 1 missing. We're one short. And then Navarro was like, he's still out there. Or he's out there. It was something pretty cheesy like that. And what I wrote in my notes watching it was, at this point, and it goes back to what you're saying last week, it seems like at times I'm watching a CBS procedural with HBO production values.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that can get really, really frustrating. But I think it was a jump up from last week.
I agree. I gave this episode, I think last week I gave it 7.5. I gave this one an 8. There's just so much good happening in this episode. We mentioned what we both think is probably the best scene of the entire series or season so far. Really atmospherically, I think it took another creepy step up.
Sure.
I think
give us the creeps. Give us more creepy stuff.
Yeah, and I think that this case is at least interesting, and there's a lot of nuance to it.
Yes.
It just, again, there's these moments of, and you know, maybe, and I just thought of this just now, I could be completely wrong. You heard Issa Lopez talk. Is there any chance that this dialogue problem can come from it being a second language?
No, she did not mention that in the episode I listened to, and I don't. Maybe it could be. But you got to think that the people in the HBO team, especially with the cost cutting corners, they're at least going to have like a script dialogue manager or something like that. Yeah. And to iron out some of those differences, I would imagine.
That last line of dialogue it needed to be so important and so impactful. And again, like you said, it felt just generic instead of being like, Nordstrom, it was Family Dollar is what it felt like to me. It just was like, you know, it was Keystone Light and instead of I don't know, what's a Michelob Ultra? I don't know.
they
Miller High Life.
It could have been they didn't even need that very, very last line. It could have just been a look shared between Danvers and Navarro, and the audience could have been left up to our own devices to be like, oh, it's obviously Clark.
Yeah. Show, don't tell. I mean, that's just show, don't tell. That's all. I mean, this is 101 stuff, right? In my opinion. Yeah. Right. I also thought it felt I felt like it was kind of undercutting of Danvers too, who we had this whole scene earlier where she's like, ask the right questions and she's not asking the right questions, right?
Right.
Like she's not that it just was, maybe that was the point. I don't know. It just felt clunky and a very, I was so disappointed with the way this episode ended.
Sure. Yeah. Well, if they improve as much on episode 3 from 2 as they did on 2 from 1, that will be pleasantly surprised and it'll be back on track, I think.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Hopefully they keep the momentum going.
Yeah. The highs in this are super high and the lows aren't nearly as low. Like, even though there's a couple parts where I was like, I'm more annoyed than anything. Yeah. It wasn't nearly as bad as the first episode.
Right.
In terms of that. Yeah, I think let's just do some real quick. Let's just do some of our own investigation and what we think is happening. So I think we both might be in agreement here that something in the ice has triggered them to be off.
Yes.
Or at least something happened that caused them to lose it. I don't think that Clark subdued the rest of his colleagues and drugged them onto the snow.
No,
I think you don't either. Okay, I don't think that's the case either. And I also I don't know that I believe that Clark killed Annie.
Yeah, I think it's too early. It's only a third of way through the season to say this is Clark and announce the hunt for Clark. I don't think that's going to work in this situation. To get back what you're saying about what's under the ice, again, I think it's going to go back to the tension between the white people and the indigenous people, just be from a socioeconomic aspect because of all the drilling. It's made the water bad. And whether in the water, something in the water is a prion or a virus or a microbe or some element of the supernatural, I think the key to whatever has happened to the guys at the station is in the water. Or under the ice. Yeah.
I think honestly that the key to solving the case is Clark, but sure. I think it's knowledge that he has, not that it's necessarily him. Right.
Right. Absolutely.
I fully expect to be surprised. Like, I feel like they are setting us up to, and it's something that True Detective hasn't really done in the past. Mm-hmm. They've teased a lot of things, even in season one, there was a lot of teasing of things. But there was never a twist.
Sure.
In any of these seasons. And I feel like maybe we're heading to a solid twist. I could be wrong.
Can that twist be, Matthew McConaughey is an executive producer. Is Rust Cole and the true time is a flat circle fashion? Is he coming back to Alaska to crack the case?
How crazy would that be? I mean,
that's probably not going to happen, but I mean, it could lead up to that. I don't even know if I want that to happen.
No, right. And I don't see the thing is, if it did happen, it's one of those things where we, in today's media landscape, in today's, people are constantly revealing secrets about things. Sure. We don't get those surprises.
Right.
Like, I'll never forget sitting in a theater and watching M. Night Shyamalan Split and them revealing at the very end, after it's essentially over, there's just like a little epilogue at the end that, this is a sequel to Unbreakable. And I lost my shit. It made the movie, in my mind, was good. I enjoyed Split. Yeah. But it made it so much better that, one, this was not leaked. No one knew this. They filmed all of this and it's in today's media. No one knew. If that was the case and this happens, what you're saying, bravo to them. Like, bravo. Absolutely. Whether it's pulled off or not, like, the fact that they were able to keep that a secret, I will give them an extra notch on the belt.
It would be, all the way, like, the time is the flat circle, like I just said, and it would be cool. Hopefully it would be done the right way. Probably not going to happen. One thing that I think we need to talk to our viewers about, we can do it quickly, it's the Tuttle family, too.
Oh, yeah.
They funded Sala. And for the listeners out there, the Tuttle family was the big connected politically and financially family that was running girls and everything else and kids in season one. So I doubt that is a coincidence. It seems like the Tuttle family are creeps and they'd be looking for a cure to end aging, to stay healthy, to make money, whatever. So that's just an extra wrench that we should watch out for moving forward.
Yeah, And the Tuttles are, I guess you could say, a cult, right? I mean, sure. That's they basically use their money power to I guess victimize, but also like entrance people to do sure. the bidding. I could see it being tangentially like the Tuttles, but I could also see it being like them spreading their cult, right?
Sure, right.
I don't think that's surprising. I think that makes sense, right?
Sure.
I love it. I love the way that we're, again, going back to season one. I can see why people may, I haven't heard anybody complain about it, but there's nothing wrong with tying this in. And I think that it makes it more interesting, and it gets the internet buzzing. Mm-hmm. So I'm here for that. I love asking these. I love a show that makes me like ask questions outside of the box. So
it's fun. It's fun. Yeah, this is just a fun exercise, and it's a fun show to watch, and it's fun to think about.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to add before we?
The very last thing I'd like to add is, I think one character we have to watch out for is the woman who knocked out the man at the very beginning of episode one, the woman in the Blue King Crab Factory.
Yeah.
She's been given a couple lines, and she was a cleaner at a house cleaner at Sala. And I don't know. Keep an eye on her. That's all I got to think of.
I agree, because she definitely made a face too as she walked away from the questioning. They kept her in the screen just long enough for her to make an awkward face. So that's a great point. I think too. Also, we're going to see, much like season one, where there were people in small towns that were connected via influence and stuff. I think we're going to see that pop up too. That could involve Peter's dad on the force,
right?
And it could involve workers in the mine. It could, I think that this is all going to be connected as well.
Absolutely.
And what's crazy is, next week we're going to be halfway through the season.
Yeah. After next week, they're going to have 3 hours to wrap it up. So,
yeah.
See how it goes.
All right, Aaron, let us know where we can find more of your work on the internet.
Come check me out at suburbandadpop.blog. A beloved local radio station in Columbus is going out of business on January 31st. It used to be 101.1, and then it was 102.5, and now it's 92.9. I'm writing a love letter to the universe, or to that radio station, as they sign off for the last time on January 31st. That should be out. Next Monday, I believe, is the 28th. Anyway, somewhere around, Monday the 29th. Please check out my work at suburbandadpop.blog.
What a bummer that it's going away. It's been 15 years since I lived in Columbus, but the only radio station I would listen to, and it's one of, and I do mean this truly, it's one of the best radio stations that I've ever came across.
When you were listening to it 15 years ago, it was still 101.1.
Yeah, 101.1, yep.
Yeah.
CD 101 is what we affectionately called it. Just a bummer. They played music that you didn't hear anywhere else, really.
Yeah, that's correct.
Good music. Well, I look forward to reading that. I'm glad you're doing that. I'm sure it'll make me misty. I had some friends who were pretty close to Andy Man.
Andy Man Davis.
Yes, Andy Man. Met him a few times. He was just a larger than life personality and a beautiful
literally
human being.
And figuratively.
Yeah. Beautiful, great voice, great radio voice.
Yeah.
Just a one of Columbus's true characters.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Check out my TikTok. I'm going to be doing some basketball stuff. Don't want to go off on a tangent here. We can maybe talk about it off on air. Today was a crazy day for NBA. I'm going to make a TikTok here in the next few minutes after I get off here with Aaron. And so check out Midnight Film Review on Instagram. and thecultofpop.com. We will catch you on the flip side.